In 1960, though, my grandfather had not yet been tested. The disappointments would come later, and even then they would come slowly, without the violence that might have changed him, for better or for worse. In the back of his mind, he had come to consider himself something of a free thinker, bohemian even. He wrote poetry on occasion, listened to jazz, counted a number of Jews he'd met in the furniture business as his closest friends. In his only skirmish into organized religion, he would enroll the family in the local Unitarian Universalist congregation. He liked the idea that Unitarians drew on the scriptures of all the great religions. "It's like you get five religions in one," he would say. Toot would eventually dissuade him of his views on the church. "For Christ's sake, Stanley, religion's not supposed to be like buying breakfast cereal." But if my grandmother was more skeptical by nature, and disagreed with Gramps on some of his more outlandish notions, her stubborn independence, her own insistence on thinking something through for herself, generally brought them into rough alignment. All this marked them as vaguely liberal, although their ideas would never congeal into anything like a firm ideology. In this, too, they were American. And so, when my mother came home one day and mentioned a friend she had met at the University of Hawaii, an African student named Barack, their first impulse was to invite him over for dinner. "The poor kid's probably lonely," Gramps would have thought, "so far away from home. Better take a look at him," Toot would have said to herself. When my father arrived at the door, Gramps might have been immediately struck by the African's resemblance to Nat King Cole, one of his favorite singers. I imagine him asking my father if he can sing, not understanding the mortified look on my mother's face. Gramps is probably too busy telling one of his jokes, or arguing with Toot over how to cook the steaks, to notice my mother reach out and squeeze the smooth, sinewy hand beside hers. Toot notices, but she's polite enough to bite her lip and offer dessert. Her instincts warn her against making a scene. When the evening is over, they'll both remark on how intelligent the young man seems, so dignified with the measured gestures, the graceful draping of one leg over another, and how about that accent? But would they let their daughter marry one? We don't know yet. The story to this point doesn't explain enough. The truth is that, like most white Americans at the time, they had never really given black people much thought. Jim Crow had made its way north into Kansas well before my grandparents were born, but at least around Wichita it appeared in its more informal, genteel form, without much of the violence that pervaded the Deep South. The same unspoken codes that governed life among whites kept contact between the races to a minimum. When black people appear at all in the Kansas of my grandparents' memories, the images are fleeting. Black men who come around the oil fields once in a while searching for work as hired hands. Black women taking in the white folks' laundry or helping clean white homes. Blacks are there but not there, like Sam the piano player or Beulah the maid or Amos and Andy on the radio. Shadowy, silent presences that elicit neither passion nor fear. It wasn't until my family moved to Texas, after the war, that questions of race began to intrude on their lives. During his first week on the job there, Gramps received some friendly advice from his fellow furniture salesman about serving black and Mexican customers. "If the coloreds want to look at the merchandise, they need to come around after hours and arrange for their own delivery." Later, at the bank where she worked, Toot made the acquaintance of the janitor, a tall and dignified black World War II vet she remembers only as Mr. Reed. While the two of them chatted in the hallway one day, a secretary in the office stormed up and hissed that Toot should never, ever call no nigger mister. Not long afterward, Toot would find Mr. Reed in a corner of the building weeping quietly to himself. When she asked him what was wrong, he straightened his back, dried his eyes, and responded with a question of his own. "What have we ever done to be treated so mean?"